welcome to The Golfing Mind, the podcast which talks about golf in all its many incarnations and in its wonder and in its glory. We look at the game, the players, the courses, the history, all aspects of golf, but with a slant on the mental game. And where possible, we will reflect on the mental aspect of the game, and where it's not appropriate, we don't. And today, I think we will be looking at the mental game in some detail. But before I discuss the topic, I'd like to welcome my co-host today, a man who is not the East Lancashire under 14 long drive champion, Neil Faulkner. Neil, welcome.
Robin, how very nice to see you.
Well, very nice to see you too. And it's good to have you with us in the show. So I'm delighted you're joining us today. What we're going to talk about today, Neil, we're going to talk about this concept of what should players do, what can players do, or what have players done when their game goes south, when it all goes wrong, when you have a catastrophic loss of form on the course, or which might last an hour, it might last a couple of days. Have you ever suffered a loss of form that lasted longer than... I knew the answer to this.
I think this is a rhetorical question.
let he without sin cast the first stone.
Very sorry to miss the last podcast on Bunker Play, Robin, especially because it leads so nicely into when it all goes south. And I recall standing on the middle of the 18th fairway at Glasgow Gael some 30 years ago as I watched you close out your match on number 18 from the left-hand bunker, which I think they charged. I think they charged you overnight rent for that bunker stay, didn't they?
Yeah, they nearly did. To put it in context, I was one up coming down 17 against my nemesis, an American fella, a good friend, Richard Van Den Bosch. And he and I both put a ball in the same bunker, but he was further away, so he had to play. And he took seven shots to get out the bunker. Now, I'm one up, so I now could putt out the back of the bunker. But I thought, now, show them what you can do. And I took eight to get out the bunker, and I lost the hole and was in shock coming down 18. And I remember sitting in the locker room sort of distraught, and you came in and just... you know, said the most comforting words I've ever heard. I think you said to me, "You cost us the cup," or something.
Do you know, one of the things we might talk about in these few minutes is the effect of your mental fatigue, trauma, whatever it may be, on the other player. And it's clear that Richard Van Den Bosch, who took seven in the bunker, must still have thought he was in the game.
the worst thing of all. For the rest of his life, he'll only remember he won the match. You know, for the rest of his life, he goes, "Oh, I won. I mean, I could have tied the match in 18. I could have won the match in 18, but I was a basket case." And that was one of the reasons, amongst a myriad of others, that got me very interested in seeing, is there some mystery I can unlock that can help that never repeat itself? So, but, you know, it kind of goes...
I don't know. I thought about this in two ways. I thought about the technical aspects to start with. And, of course, I suppose the times when you're most under pressure on a golf course might be when you're playing, let's say, in a high wind on a tight seaside golf course, and you lose your swing. What do you do at that point? I think the thing you do is you go to your go-to shot, don't you? If you have a good go-to shot, you to stay in the game, especially if, as what we are usually doing, playing foursomes, or playing match play golf, we're not playing against the course, we're playing against the man, and you just find a way to get it round. What is your go-to shot? What would your go-to shot have been in that bunker? Would it have been the clunk out sideways, making sure you were
whacking
it as hard as you could, three or four inches behind the ball? Don't know.
The go-to shot I would have been taking a 9-iron and playing out backwards and just chipping it out the green. I mean, that's not a difficult shot to play, but anyway, it was a very difficult bunker shot. I need the listeners to know. I should have put that bunker in the hardest bunker in the world in last week's podcast. But what about yourself? I mean, do you have a go-to shot if you're playing really badly?
Do you know, I wish I could say I had. My go-to shot is try and hit it, find it. Hit it, find it. And actually, I think I can hit a reasonably controllable fade, not very far. So if that gets you 80% of what a good shot would get you, and you're able just to keep the ball in play off tee by hitting that shot, then do that.
Yeah, but you know,
play the same for your second chip. See if you can single putt, stay in the game.
Yeah, I mean,
if you try and recover your form by hitting your A1 shot on a tight fairway in the wind when you've lost your game, then you're in for all sorts of misery, aren't you?
You are indeed. But professionals often talk about playing badly but scoring well. You know, playing ugly. You know, and I think there's something we can learn from that. I think that if you're playing badly, it's all. I think what the Americans or the professionals will say, we have to accept you're playing badly and make the best of it. And I think you're saying having a go-to shot's absolutely critical. You need to have one shot in your bag that's your fail-safe shot. But I do wonder, you know, my logic has often been when you have a really bad day in the golf course, so your game's gone south, just accept it. You know, don't beat yourself up and think, oh, I should be playing a lot better than that, because that's just not right. You know, I think that if you can just accept it. I remember when I joined a particular golf club in Scotland, a few weeks before I joined it, I got invited to play with the captain. And the pressure I felt, and what was interesting and really interesting, was a few weeks before, I'd bought a set of secondhand golf clubs, or as they say in America, pre-used or pre-loved. And there were Mizuno somethings. And I remember buying them and testing them at the golf club up in the north of Scotland and hitting everyone out the middle of the club and thinking, I need to buy these. And I bought these irons and I brought them with me to the club where I was going to play against with the captain. And suddenly somebody looked and said, oh, you must be a good player. I said, why? He goes, oh, they're Mizuno TP64s. They're blades. I mean, they're really, and they're smaller heads than average. And I looked at the clubs and I looked at other people's clubs and I went, oh God, what have I done? And I just had a complete loss of confidence. But, and here's the but, I concentrated so hard on every shot and swung so easy that I played some of the best golf I played. And I then got rid of the clubs the following week. So I knew lightning doesn't strike twice in the same place. So I think attitude's important. Is if it goes south, but if this podcast is trying to help people what they can do if their game goes south. So what would your advice be to someone like, do you remember Peter Baker Finch?
I do remember Peter Baker Finch. Yes.
Here's another name for you. David Duval.
Yes. One at Lytham, I think, didn't he? Both British Open champions or Open
here's
champions.
Another one for you. Bill Rogers.
Bill Rogers also won the Open at Sandwich. And also, I think the same year won the US Open or possibly the next year.
In 81, he won the Open Championship and he won four PGA events that year. What was interesting with those three players is I think none of them play golf anymore. And within 3 years, they were out the world's top 100 in the rankings. So you've gone from being a major winner in the top 10 to suddenly it's all gone. And some of them, I think, never picked up a club again. But so for the club golf,
that's about what that may well be about. Golf being your job, may it not?
Yes.
If golf is your job and not your
joy.
Passion, yeah. I suppose I'm picking over my words a bit here. But if that's the case, then when you finish, you choose not to do it again.
Yeah.
I mean, is it the same thing with accountants who are usually the worst people at preparing their own tax returns, or doctors who don't look after their health terribly well because what they do for their day job is something they don't want to take home with them?
Yeah, do as I do, don't do as I say. Or do as I say, don't do as I do. I do believe that it's worth leaving the game for a few months. Have you ever taken a break from the game? Or do you know anyone who has? Do you know any players who've ever taken a voluntary break from the game? Who said, You know, I'm not picking up clubs. I mean, I know that McIlroy puts his clubs down. And Bobby Jones famously, I hope you notice I'm not mentioning Ben Hogan. Bobby Jones famously, when he, at the end of the season in October, would allegedly put his golf clubs on top of his wardrobe at home and not touch them until March the following year. So I think taking time off.
Well, Bobby Jones, by the time Bobby Jones retired when he was 28, having won the impregnable quadrilateral, as they called the Grand Slam in those days, he had taken and passed 3 degrees in engineering, English literature, and law. Was working pretty much full time in a law firm. Apart from the, I don't know, between 6 and 8 tournaments he played a year, which he sharpened up a bit on playing. Was it East Lake or Peachtree? East Lake, I think, playing course, wasn't it?
The other thing.
So yeah, he didn't play a great deal of golf, frankly.
And here's a curious little aside on Bobby Jones. You may or may not know this. When he went to Harvard, I think he went there to study. I think he went there to do English literature, because I think he did law at Emory. But he went there because he'd already played golf for his university at his first university. I can't remember the name of it. He wasn't eligible to play for the Harvard golf team. So he volunteered to be there. Sort of bagman, the guy that kept the clubs clean and looked after them. So he used to go to matches with them to encourage them, but he wasn't allowed to play. So could you imagine that? You're playing for Harvard, and there's a four-time major winner, greatest amateur in the history of the game, but he can't play, you know, and he's just said, oh, I've just watched your That's great.
Yeah, you imagine the opposition pitching up and saying, they must have a great side. Look who's on their bench.
Can't make the team. But you know, even Bobby Jones, I mean, I know he got ill health, but when the advent of steel shafts came in, his timing didn't work for steel shafts. And they said that, you know, that was another factor that made him give up the game. My feeling is that, look, you're going to have bad days in the golf course, accept it. If you've got a run of bad play, I think 3 things to do. You've lost your confidence. You've got to build your confidence back. You've got to find a way to build your confidence back. And I hope you don't mind me sharing this with the many listeners to the podcast, but I know you lost your short game for a while. And it was people used to turn away and they couldn't look. I mean, you almost had the yips with the wedge. And I remember the last time I beat you at North Berwick, you had a sort of 30-yard wedge shot after a super drive to get up and down to win the match, and you skidded it across the green. And to your credit, you didn't swear for more than 60 seconds, which I thought was very good. So, and seriously, Neil, you did have a terrible slump. And did you have a strategy to getting the game back?
Thanks for bringing that up, Robin. I have got it. Yes, I have. I have got over it. As Doug Saunders used to say to the question, do you ever think about the 3-foot putt you missed on the last to win the British Open for Nick Lowe to go past you? He said, well, I rarely think about it more than every 5 minutes these days.
Yeah.
What did I do? I do not profess to have a good short game anymore, but now, nor have I ever had a short game, but it is a bit better than it used to be. And What I did was I tried to find a go-to shot. I tried to find a way to technically hit the ball and to make sure it hit the center of the club, which should not be a very difficult thing to do, given that your backswing is only half length at most. But try to do that and to practice that so that you have a degree of confidence in it. And then go to what the pros talk about, which is trying to find a process of standing up, taking a practice swing, standing to the ball, hitting it. And also mentally, of course, reading Silent Mind Golf, which is very helpful on that, as was the advice from Porrig Harrington, who apparently in times when he is struggling mentally will recite the 37 times table, which you may think rather banal and ridiculous or whatever, but if you try and recite the 37 times table, it means your brain is engaged on something other than the golf shot which you might otherwise be fearing.
That makes perfect sense.
What you do is you rely on your process and your technique.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I think that the thinking is almost can become a virus for some people. You can overthink every shot, and the thinking process isn't about how should I hit the shot. The thinking process is what I don't want to happen with this shot. How I don't want to thin it, knife it, dunch it, shank it. I mean, the shanks is one of these things when you've got them, you've got them. But I only have to look back to Bernard Langer. There's a man who allegedly has overcome the yips three times, the putting yips. I mean, his putting, and you show me a putting technique he hasn't used, I'll be surprised. Long putter, cross-handed, cack-handed, left-handed, but he's overdone it. So I think if we ever want encouragement to know that no matter how bad your golf gets, you can come back. I think for the average club golfer, and I always say this, you've got to rebuild your confidence. And the best way to do that is take a break for 4 weeks and then get a series of lessons and have someone give you a very good swing thought to look at. And then I would often say to people, sell your clubs, sell your golf bag, sell your
take up tennis. Yeah.
No, and then buy something and buy new clubs. I mean, you don't look the same, dress differently. Just get, but build your confidence, because I think it is all down to a loss of confidence. It's an absolute loss of confidence. And I often ask people, imagine that you were playing in the medal at your local golf course, but imagine somebody arrived at your house and said, I come from the future and you win this competition tomorrow by 8 shots. I've been to the future. You shoot a 66. You win it by 8 shots. I'm going to show you video of you winning this tournament to prove to you that I come from the future. So you watch this bit of video from the future, and indeed you've got to win this competition by 8 shots, by shooting a phenomenal 66. How would you feel the next day when you actually teed it up for real, knowing you're going to win by 8 shots? You'd feel so relaxed. Well, maybe you wouldn't. You'd find a way to go, ooh, can I
get out of that clown costume. Yeah. Yes.
No, but no,
just back on the first aspect of that point about stopping playing or whatever. Jack Nicklaus used to stop playing around October time and put his clubs away. And what he did at the start of every season is he went back with his longtime coach, Jack Grout, was it? Okay, he would go back to his long-term coach and they would start from the very beginning. So they would take an hour or two to make sure his grip was right, and they would take an hour or two to make sure that his alignment was correct and proper. And it was only at that point, once they'd got the basics right, that they'd start hitting a golf ball. And it clearly worked for him.
No, but it's true. I think a lot of people go down wormholes and trying to improve their game, and they look for, you just need to go on YouTube and look at the thousands of game improvement tips people give, it might be give you a quick fix, I don't know, but you just need to go down to the range in a professional tournament. And Sandy Lyle, the number of gimmicks towards the end of his career, he had towels under one arm, he had one eye closed, he had, balancing a banana on his head. All these ways of trying to help him swing better. And there he was, probably the greatest natural golfer that Europe ever produced. I mean, didn't Seve Ballesteros once say, if everyone played their best golf all the time, Sandy Lyle would win everything and I'd come second?
So I think he did say that. I am surprised to hear that story about Lyle, though. I thought he was always just a very natural and very talented player who didn't think a great deal about his game. He just hit it.
Yeah.
And off he went. No, the story, is this a related story? Don't know. Let me tell it anyway. The story I recall is about Paul Laurie, who won the Open in 1999, I think, at Carnoustie. And it disappeared for a number of years afterwards, really, from the top of the world rankings. And when he came back, was asked what had happened. And his explanation was that he didn't think himself worthy of winning the Open. He didn't think he was a worthy Open champion and that he needed to play a better game. And so tried to change his game to become a more complete golfer. And of course, lost what he had throughout the baby rather than the bathwater. And only a few years later, when he thought, well, I'll go back to my basics, what I understand, how I play the game, how I sense the game, only then did he recover his terrific form.
Well, that's an interesting story. I think it is relevant. I think that, again, what you're talking about is a loss of confidence, a loss of belief. It's interesting, our other co-host, Mike Kershaw, who's not with us today, you know,
never lost his belief, ever.
No, no.
In spite of every reason for doing so.
But no, I agree. And it's interesting, one of the first things I've often said to golfers when I've been working with them, and one of the first questions I say to people is, what kind of putter are you? And people might say, I'm not a good putter. I'm a bit streaky. I'm so-so. Very, very, very few people ever say, I'm a great putter. I'm a really good putter. You ask Mike Kershaw, are you a good putter? And he goes, I'm good, me. I'm a great putter, me. And he has that with every club in his bag. And I think that's important. You know, I think this belief, and I think when you have a loss of form, you've lost your confidence and you need to build it up. And think Jack Nicklaus, going back to the fundamentals with Jack Grout, you can see what he was doing there. He was just reinforcing that belief that he had had good golf. But, you know, before we wrap up, you know, the only thing I would...
The Henry Ford line, isn't it?
What's that?
Whether you think you can or whether you think you can't, you're probably right.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I would want to add one other thing to this podcast, and you may disagree with this, but I would say the average golfer, and that includes you and me, but I'm going to redact myself from this. Is that a legal term? Redact? I'm going to excuse myself. I think the average
golfer... I have no idea where this sentence is going.
Okay, I think the average golfer overestimates their ability, and therefore they have unrealistic expectations of what they should be achieving on the golf course. So they expect it every shot well. In reality, was it Walter Hagen who said, I expect to hit 7 bad shots around, so when I hit them, I don't get upset. Do you think that's true?
Perhaps that's right. Or perhaps the other way of looking at the same point is that you shouldn't get upset about something that's happened. What a lot of golfers tend to do, I think, is hit a bad shot, and then because they're angry or upset or expect the same result next time, hit another bad shot. And that's what makes their golf, that's what exaggerates a particularly bad shot, is that they didn't recover from it quickly enough. I do remember we went together to the Open Championship two or three years ago, didn't we?
You did.
Must have been 2 years ago at George's. And one of the most interesting things was seeing the reaction of players who hit bad shots, missing greens by often significant ways, missing fairways, that what they did, what they seemed to do, is just set up for the next shot as if nothing had happened. There was no sense that they needed to get up and down for a par and this was more difficult because they'd hit a bad shot. What they were just interested in is the next shot. Forgotten the last one.
No, it's true. Do you know, there's a very interesting quotation from Harry Vardon. I can't remember the exact quotation, but he gave this advice to players, and I think it's brilliant advice. He said, you often see someone hitting a bad shot from the middle of the fairway or off the tee or from the bunker. They hit a bad shot. The next thing you see them do is stand in the same spot and take 3 or 4 swings right at the site of the bad shot. He said he would never, ever do that. Vardon said if he hit a great shot, he would then stand in the spot and take 2 or 3 swings to embed the feeling of greatness, to embed that feeling of, that's what a good shot feels like. He said, if you take a couple of swings immediately after a bad shot, you're reinforcing the feeling of badness. I think there's something in that. And exactly validates what you're saying about the professionals. They hit a bad shot, they wouldn't then stand and take more. They'd walk on and get on with it. But you know, it's their job. It's not our job. It's our job just to criticize them and tell them what they tell them what they're doing better, obviously.
Obviously, well, it depends on your reaction to the bad shot as well. Tommy Bolt used to regularly throw a club if he had a bad shot. And hence, of course, the old quote of Tommy's caddy from the middle of the 17th fairway when he asked for a club from his caddy. His caddy said, "Well, it's either a 4 iron or an 8 iron." He said, "Well, how can it be either a 4 iron or 8 iron? Well, that's all we have left."
You know, it's funny. I think Tommy Bolt, or Thunderbolt as he was known, played up to the crowds and played up to that fiery nature. Eric Brown, who we talked about in the Bunker podcast last week, was known for being incredibly fiery. But I guess we've gone off topic a little bit here. But I do think that my takeaway from today's podcast is, as an amateur golfer, you're going to have runs of bad luck. Don't get upset about it. Just let it be. If it continues for more than 2 or 3 rounds, get a lesson. If it continues longer than that, buy new clubs and take a break from the game. But don't get down on yourself. Don't get down on yourself.
And remember, the only person who cares is you.
You know, that's so true. You must have played in games where somebody's having a nightmare. You don't even feel sorry for them. You're not even thinking, "I'm glad it's not me." You just don't want them to feel humiliated. You don't. I mean, I played at Royal Porthcawl some weeks ago, and I have had a bad back. So for the first 9 holes, I was playing atrocious golf. And then I hit a semi-decent shot, and the other 3 people went, "Oh, good shot. Well played." They were very keen to find something positive. I felt patronized at that point. So I obviously accepted their praise and asked them why it was so long in coming. But I'm very empathetic to people who are having a nightmare on the golf course. And I remember, what do they say in foursomes? Never apologize.
Never explain. Never apologize.
Never explained. Well, that's quite right. Well, that's it. Anything you want to add before we wrap up?
If you've a particular problem with your mental game, then Silent Mind Golf is the way. Is that right, Robin?
Well, I sent you a script and you haven't memorized it, obviously. I need to point out to listeners that these plugs for Silent Mind Golf that Mike and Neil give, they're doing it more from a position of, let's just say, irony or sarcasm, as opposed to being on a commission of any kind.
Well, you're right about the commission.
Yeah, I know it's done with a warm heart and a good feeling, but they're not put up to it by me. That's what you need to record. You know, I wait until Title has come and offer me a sponsorship deal or something like that before I start nakedly plugging my own books. As I always say, if you're really keen, go to seagirdgolf.com, and everything you might need to know about the mental game of golf that I'm involved in can be found there. But Neil, thank you for your time this week. It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed it. And I look forward
to chatting, Robin.
As always. And until wherever you are in the world, enjoy your golf, play well, and we'll speak to you next time. Take care.